Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Midnight Blood by Adam Wright, narrated by Greg D. Barnett. 1. It was about 9 o'clock in the morning, mid-October, with the sun glaring off the wet highway and into my eyes as I drove the Land Rover east out of Dearmont toward the Hawthorne estate. I'd never heard of the Hawthornes, one of the richest families in Maine, but Felicity had recognized the name straight away when we'd gotten a call from one of their staff this morning, requesting my presence at the estate at my earliest convenience. Since we didn't have any ongoing cases at the moment, my earliest convenience was right now. So here I was, driving out to the estate while Felicity stayed in the office in case any more work came in. The phone wouldn't exactly be ringing off the hook, so she was using the spare time to research Arthurian legends, trying to figure out why Sheriff Cantrell had been put into some sort of magical sleep after touching Excalibur in my basement. As I turned off the highway and followed a long, neat driveway up to a set of wrought iron gates, I hoped that this job would be simple and would pay well. We'd put away the Sammy Martin file yesterday, after receiving a letter from his mother that left us in no doubt that the case was closed forever. Both Felicity and I were nursing wounds we'd received while investigating Sammy's disappearance, and I wasn't in a hurry to collect any more scars. A red brick security booth sat by the gate. A guard wearing sunglasses emerged from the door and strode over to the Land Rover. He was dressed in a tight-fitting dark blue uniform and a cap that bore the name Hawthorne in white stitched lettering on the front. His bulging biceps and overdeveloped neck muscles spoke of long hours in the gym. As I wound down the window, he stood with his hands on his hips and shot me a look that was probably unfriendly, but was lost behind the shades.
"Help you, pal?"
"I'm here to see Charles Hawthorne," I told him. "I'm expected."
"Name?"
"Alec Harbinger." His steely gaze took in my black jacket, white tee, and red flannel shirt, and I noticed one eyebrow rise slightly in amusement. I probably wasn't everything the well-dressed preternatural investigator ought to be, at least not in the eyes of this guard or the people who lived in the mansion beyond the gate, but he was just going to have to deal with that.
"Yeah, I was told about you."
He turned on his heels and went back into the booth. A low buzz sounded from somewhere, and the gate swung inward. I drove forward along a road that curved gently to a gravel parking area in front of the house. There were half a dozen cars sitting there, Ferraris, Bentleys, and Maseratis gleaming in the morning light. I parked the Land Rover some distance away and killed the engine. As I got out, the house's big double doors opened. A middle-aged man in a butler's uniform came out to greet me.
"Mr. Harbinger, thank you for arriving promptly. Mr. Hawthorne is waiting in the foyer."
As I looked at the butler's black morning coat, gray vest, white dress shirt, and black tie, I got the feeling I was underdressed for the impending interview with Mr. Hawthorne. At least he wasn't hiring me for my dress sense. I knew as much about Armani as Hawthorne probably knew about killing monsters. "The folly," I said, trying to remember if I'd been inside a folly ever in my life, and deciding quickly that I hadn't. "Lead the way." He led me to the side of the building, where a golf cart waited. I climbed into the passenger side while he got behind the wheel and turned on the engine. The cart purred into life, and the butler gently pressed the gas pedal, taking us along a path that cut through a stand of pine trees and then led to a small lake, on the edge of which stood a building that looked like a small Greek temple.
"Does Mr. Hawthorne usually conduct business out here?" I asked. "Not usually, no, but the matter at hand is quite delicate, so he would rather speak with you in the folly than in the house."
I turned in my seat to look at the house behind us. Either there was someone in there that Hawthorne didn't want to overhear our conversation, or he was embarrassed about hiring a preternatural investigator. This wasn't the first time I'd been hired in a clandestine manner, and it probably wouldn't be the last. The golf cart came to a stop by a faux temple, and I got out. Without a word, the butler turned the cart around and drove back toward the house. I inspected the folly. It had obviously been built by someone with a love of classical Greek architecture,
fashioned of white marble with fluted pillars supporting a high-ridged roof. A frieze showed Perseus fighting Medusa, sword raised above his head, ready to strike a blow that would never land, because he was nothing more than a piece of sculpted decoration, as was his snake-haired opponent.
"Mr. Harbinger!"
The low voice came from within the structure. I stepped between the pillars into the folly, where a white marble table sat at the center of a room, and similarly carved benches ran along the walls. There was one seat in here that wasn't fashioned of white marble, and that was a wheelchair, in which sat a man I guessed to be in his 60s. He wore a tan jacket and trousers, and an open-collared, cream-colored shirt. His close-cropped hair and beard were as white as the marble that surrounded us. "Mr. Hawthorne, I presume?" He gave me a curt nod.
"You presume correctly. I am Charles Hawthorne. Forgive me for not receiving you at the house, but the matter I wish to discuss is rather delicate."
"Understood." As I'd told Felicity recently, everybody hates PIs. Even the people who hire us are usually embarrassed about it. "What can I do for you, Mr. Hawthorne?" He pushed a lever on the arm of the wheelchair and it rolled closer to the table.
"I need your protection. Someone is trying to kill me with magic."
I indicated one of the stone benches. "May I?" He nodded.
"Of course."
I sat on the hard, smooth surface and said, "Are you sure someone is trying to kill you?"
"Very sure. And don't tell me to go to the police. When you hear what I have to say, you'll see that my situation requires someone in your line of work, and not someone who works for the local sheriff's department."
"Okay, I'm listening." He reached into his jacket pocket and brought out a small leather pouch, which he tossed over to me. I caught it and turned it over in my hands, inspecting it. Symbols were painted in red on the dark leather, a circle, a star, and a cross. I opened the pouch and looked inside. There was some white hair in there and a tiny piece of parchment. I took the parchment out and examined it. More symbols, these written in black ink. A combination of curving lines, geometric shapes, and dots.
"Do you know what those symbols mean?" Hawthorne asked.
"Not exactly, but this is a hex bag, so they're probably part of some spell or other. I assume the hair in the bag is yours, binding the spell to you. Where did you find this?"
"I discovered it 2 weeks ago, beneath my bed. I have no idea how long it had been there before that. I only found it because I was looking for my reading glasses, which were missing from the nightstand."
"Were they under the bed, too?"
"No, I didn't find them."
"Well, it looks like someone has either hexed you or is trying to scare you." I held the bag up. "Is this why you think someone is trying to kill you?"
"Of course not. Do you think I'm a fool? There's more to this than a bag beneath my bed."
His gaze moved from me to the quiet lake beyond the pillars.
"I used to take great pleasure in walking around the grounds of the estate. I'd stroll down to the lake most evenings and sit on the steps of the folly while the sun went down. One evening last week, I sat on the steps over there."
He pointed to a set of marble steps that led down to the lake.
"And couldn't get up again. All feeling fled from my legs. The doctors have no idea what is wrong with me, and I've been confined to this damned wheelchair ever since that day."
"And you think this is connected to the hex bag?"
"The bag," he said, reaching into his pocket, "and this."
He placed an object on the marble table.
"While I was in the hospital, Wesley, my butler, found this right here on the table. It must have been there while I was sitting on the steps, just a few feet away, losing the feeling in my legs."
I leaned forward and examined the object. It was a figure made from sticks and white hair that had been twisted and shaped to form a crude likeness of Hawthorne. The legs of the figure had been broken off from the torso and then tied loosely with green string so that they hung uselessly from the figure's body.
"It's voodoo, isn't it?"
Hawthorne asked.
"A voodoo doll?"
"Not necessarily," I told him. This type of sympathetic magic is practiced in many magical traditions.
But that's why my legs don't work. Because of that... that thing.
We can't say that for sure. It's a possibility, though. Do you have many enemies?
He scoffed. I'm a successful businessman, Mr. Harbinger. You don't reach the heights I have and not make some enemies. I have rivals, of course, and disgruntled ex-employees, not to mention colleagues who would like to see me gone.
But you don't think any of them is doing this, I said. You think it's someone closer than that. Your staff, perhaps, or even someone in your own family.
He narrowed his eyes. Why do you say that?
Because we're having this conversation in the Folly, and not in the house. You don't want anyone to overhear us.
Hawthorne seemed to deflate slightly, his body sinking into the wheelchair. A sadness came into his eyes.
I can't rule out anyone in my family as a suspect. There is bad blood between almost all of them. Squabbles, disloyalty, and schemes to outdo each other are commonplace. It's been like that for as long as I can remember. Money and power, Mr. Harbinger, they corrupt everyone in the end.
Then I'm glad I have neither.
He laughed.
I like you. I'm sure you're the right man for this job. And you come highly recommended by Amelia Robinson of Robinson Lubecki Lumber. I believe you sorted out some trouble for her a few months ago.
The trouble he was referring to was my first case in Dearmont. Amelia Robinson's son had been replaced with a changeling that had tried to steal the family fortune. The creature had killed Amelia's husband in the process. On the way over here, I'd wondered how Charles Hawthorne had gotten my name and number, but now that I knew he was a friend of Amelia Robinson, it made sense.
You said someone is trying to kill you, I said, picking up the stick figure. That implies that something else has happened, something more than the loss of your legs, something that made you finally call me.
Yes, I was getting to that.
Last night, an attempt was made on my life.
He spoke calmly, as if he were telling me about the weather.
I was returning home from a meeting in Boston. It was late, and my driver, Jonas, was being particularly careful because of the rain. I was tired and decided to take a nap. I had barely closed my eyes when I was woken by Jonas yelling out in surprise. I woke up just as he spun the steering wheel and sent us careening into the woods at the side of the road.
Hawthorne looked shaken for the first time since I'd met him. He stared out at the lake again as if to calm himself and took a deep breath before continuing.
I asked Jonas why he'd done such a damn fool thing, and in answer, he pointed back at the road with a trembling hand. There was something standing there, something that wasn't human.
He shook his head slightly, as if in disbelief of what he was about to say.
It was a demon. It had wings like a bat and a glowing, hateful stare. I never believed such things existed, but I can't dispute what I have seen with my own eyes.
He pointed at the hex bag and the stick figure.
Whoever used those things against me also sent that monster to kill me. I'm certain of it.
What happened after you drove off the road and saw the creature? I asked.
Another car came along the highway and stopped when the driver saw our predicament. He was an off-duty police officer. He made sure Jonas and I were okay, and then he called a tow truck.
And the creature?
Gone. The other driver never saw it. I shudder to think what might have happened if he hadn't come along when he did. I'm quite certain Jonas and I would be dead.
I mulled over everything he'd told me. It sounded as if someone was gunning for him and shooting magic bullets. But if someone wanted him dead, why not just use real bullets? They tended to be much more reliable than demons. Sure, summoning a demon to do your dirty work meant that you could be far away from the murder when it happened and have an airtight alibi. But if the summoner was someone in the Hawthorne family, why were they going to all that trouble? Surely they had enough money to simply hire a hitman and get the same airtight alibi without having to summon a creature from hell. Is anyone in your family interested in the occult? He shook his head.
I don't believe so. I'm sure they're all healthily skeptical of such things, as was I until last night.
Yet you believe one of them could be using magic against you.
Obviously one of them isn't as skeptical as I thought.
Tell me about them.
There's my wife, Jane, of course. I'd like to say I trust her implicitly, but I can't. That's why she isn't privy to this conversation.
I took a notepad and pencil from my pocket and began taking notes. Can I ask you why you don't trust her?
There was an indiscretion. Jane doesn't know I'm aware of it, but I know most things that happen where my family is concerned. You may be the first preternatural investigator in my employ, Mr. Harbinger, but I've hired private investigators in the past.
To follow your wife?
Among other things.
Who did your wife have this indiscretion with? Surely that person is a suspect. They might want you out of the way so the indiscretion can become something more. He sighed heavily.
No, you're going down the wrong path. My wife and her lover don't see each other anymore.
I looked up from my notepad. Are you sure about that?
Positive.
I wrote the word affair next to Jane Hawthorne's name and underlined it. I wasn't going to press her husband for the details right now, but I'd return to the subject later if I thought it warranted further investigation.
Does she know about the accident last night?
She knows only the lie that I told her, that a drunk driver was heading straight for us, and Jonas had to swerve to avoid a head-on collision.
Okay, I said. What about your children?
Brad is the oldest. He's 32, but acts like an 18-year-old. Jane and I spoiled him from the moment he was born, and now he's only interested in partying and fast cars. He has no sense of responsibility, no ambition.
Would he be ambitious enough to try and kill you? Hawthorne shrugged.
Who knows? At one time I would have said no, but the thought of me being dead could perhaps give him a goal he feels worth pursuing.
Does he live in the house?
Yes. Unlike Elise and Lucy, Brad has never flown the nest.
Elise and Lucy are your daughters? He nodded.
Thankfully, they didn't turn out anything like their brother. Elise is the middle child. She runs a company that promotes businesses on social media. She's good at it, too. Some of her clients are big names in the fashion and food industries. She lives in Portland, where the company is based.
I scribbled all of that into the notepad and then said, "Is there any reason why Elise might want you dead?"
"I don't believe so."
"How about Lucy?" He stroked his beard for a moment while he considered his answer. When he finally spoke, he said,
"Lucy was a strange child. From an early age, she had a fascination with death and dark things. I honestly couldn't say if she's trying to kill me because I don't really know her. I'm not sure anyone does. She's introverted and antisocial, despite her mother's repeated attempts to make her more outgoing.
Does she live here in the house?"
"No, she moved out a couple of years ago. Said she'd had enough of the arguments and dysfunctional relationships in the family. She lives in Rockport now, in a house paid for by the books she writes."
He wrinkled his nose as he said,
"Horror fiction. Lucy is the only creative in the family, and I have no idea where she inherited it from. Certainly not from her mother, or from me."
"Do you have any of her books I could take a look at?" He shrugged.
"Brad might have some. I've never read them myself. They're published under a pseudonym. I have no idea what it is. Lucy said she didn't use the family name because she didn't want an advantage when she approached the publisher. But I think there's more to it than that. I think she's ashamed of us for some reason."
So, he didn't show an interest in his daughter's work. Could that be a motive for her to summon the demon? People have been killed for less, but I wasn't going to make any assumptions until I had more evidence. It's understandable that she wanted to see if she could make it on her own, I told him.
He scoffed again.
Is it? Why not use every advantage you have? That's the only way to get anywhere in this world.
Yet Lucy made it without using the Hawthorne name, I said.
If your idea of making it is locking yourself away from the world and inventing weird stories, he said, then she's a success.
But by normal standards, she's nothing more than a recluse living in a fantasy world.
Will she speak to me if I need to visit her in the course of my investigation? He shrugged.
Possibly. I have no idea.
Do you have her address?
No.
Next to Lucy's name, I wrote, Outcast from family, possible interest in occult. Despite Charles telling me that none of his family members had an interest in the occult, it seemed obvious that Lucy might, because of her profession. Maybe Charles didn't consider her a member of the family anymore, and had excluded her from his answer to my question because of that.
As for Brad, Elise, and my wife, Hawthorne said, you can meet them tonight at our annual fall party. Lucy won't deign to make an appearance, of course, but Elise and Brad will be there.
He looked at me expectantly, as if I should know what he was talking about. Is that a family reunion? I asked. He laughed.
You really are new to Dearmont, aren't you, Mr. Harbinger?
Yes, I am, I admitted.
My wife hosts a party at the house every October. It's a family reunion of sorts, I suppose. But Jane also invites most of the business owners in Dearmont, as well as anyone else of importance. As a Dearmont business owner, you should have received an invitation. I'm surprised you didn't.
It doesn't surprise me at all, I told him. I'm not important. I'm just the local ghost catcher.
I'll have your name put on the guest list. Then you can come here tonight, meet my family, and tell me which one of them is trying to kill me.
You think I'll know which of them summoned a demon after a 5-minute conversation?
No. I thought you'd have some sort of tool you could use. A magical item that forces them to tell the truth, or one that can tell you if they're lying. Since seeing that demon on the road, I've come to the realization that my mind has been closed to many things that could have helped me in the past. Imagine if I had an item such as I just described at a board meeting, or a meeting with a rival firm. The power I'd have would be unimaginable.
And that's why magic items should be kept away from people like you, I thought to myself. I can't force someone to submit to a magical polygraph test, I told him, any more than I could force him or her to submit to a mundane one. The use of magic doesn't circumvent ethics. In fact, it makes them even more important. He frowned, seemingly confused. I should have expected a word like ethics to confuse a man like Charles Hawthorne.
But if you're not going to use magic, what are you going to do? He asked.
I'll talk to them, ask them some questions.
I could get any local gumshoe to do that. Tell me why I'm hiring you.
Because a normal PI wouldn't know what they're dealing with. They wouldn't know what questions to ask, what to look for, and most of them wouldn't even believe your story. He seemed to reflect on that for a moment, his eyes studying the patterns in the marble floor. Then he looked up at me and said,
"You're right, of course. Very well, come to the party tonight and speak to my family. Report back to me tomorrow and we'll discuss your findings. But if you come up empty-handed, then I expect you to use magic to get results. Is that understood?"
"I'll be bringing my associate with me tonight," I said, ignoring the question. "You'll need to put her on the guest list," I said. "Felicity Lake."
"Consider it done."
"I'll take the case, Mr. Hawthorne," I said. "But you need to understand that I work in my own way and in my own time." He nodded, although there was some reluctance to the movement, and his words were terse when he said,
"Just be sure to keep me appraised of your progress."
"I will," I said, putting the hex bag and stick figure into my jacket pocket. Hawthorne pressed a button on the arm of his wheelchair and said,
"Wesley, we're done here. Please take Mr. Harbinger back to his car."
"Before I go," I said, turning to a fresh page in my notepad, "who are the staff working at the house?" He thought about that for a moment before replying,
"The person you're looking for isn't a member of my staff.
None of them has any reason to do this to me. Still, I'd like to cover all the possibilities. I held the pencil over the notepad and looked at Hawthorne expectantly. He sighed.
Very well. There's Wesley, the butler you've already met. Jonas, my driver, who was with me last night. The head chef is named Sophia, and she has a staff of 3 chefs that work for her during various shifts. I don't know their names. And finally, there's our housekeeper, Ellen. But as I said, none of these people would want to harm me. We treat our staff very well here.
I wrote the names in the notepad and stood when I heard the golf cart approaching. I'll see you tonight at the party.
One more thing, Mr. Harbinger, Hawthorne said, looking me over. It's a formal event, so there is a dress code. You won't need to wear a tuxedo, but a suit is a must.
Not a problem, I said, walking between the pillars and out into the fresh morning air. Wesley was turning the golf cart around so that it pointed back along the trail. As I climbed in, I said, Have you been working with Charles Hawthorne a long time, Wesley?
I've been with Mr. Hawthorne all my life, he said proudly. My father was the butler to the late Edward Hawthorne, Charles's father. Charles and I grew up together.
So you're friends.
He looked at me pointedly. Mr. Harbinger, I am not a suspect in this case, so I would appreciate it if you didn't interrogate me as if I were.
Just passing the time, I said, sitting back in the seat. We passed the rest of the journey in silence. When we got to the house, I jumped out of the cart, and Wesley followed me across the gravel to the Land Rover. See you tonight, I said, opening the door and getting in behind the wheel.
Yes, sir.
He managed to put enough weight into those 2 words to tell me he didn't approve of my being here. I watched him as he went through the double doors and into the house. Then I started the engine and backed out of my parking spot, tires crunching on the gravel. When I got to the gate, it swung open. The security guard wasn't anywhere in sight, so I assumed he was watching me via the camera that was mounted on his booth. After driving part of the way through the gate, I stopped and waved at the camera to get his attention. A glass hatch opened and he stuck his head out, his eyes still unreadable behind the shades.
Yeah?
He asked, with all the warmth of a block of ice.
What's your name? What's that got to do with you?
I shrugged. It's a simple question. I could drive back there and ask Charles, but I don't think he'd appreciate being disturbed again. He considered that for a moment and then shrugged.
It's Brian.
Last name?
Connors.
I took the notepad out of my jacket pocket, opened it, and added his name to the list of staff members.
Thanks. Hey, what are you writing there?
Nothing you need to worry about. Throwing the notepad onto the passenger seat, I drove forward and gave him a brief wave as I passed the hatch. I wasn't sure what to make of the Hawthorne case. It seemed someone was trying to take out Charles Hawthorne by using magic, but why not use a more mundane method? Why take away his ability to walk by using an effigy in the folly and not a baseball bat to the knees? Why summon a demon to kill him when hiring an assassin would be so much easier? It didn't make any sense. My phone rang. It was Felicity. I pulled over to the side of the road and answered it.
Hey, what's up?
Alec, you need to come back to the office.
She sounded concerned.
What's wrong?
I'm not sure exactly. You'd best come back here and see for yourself.
On my way.
I ended the call and put my foot down. As I reached the highway, it began to rain. The wipers came to life and arced back and forth across the windshield in a steady metronomic rhythm. I pressed the accelerator, and the Land Rover raced along the wet highway. 2. I pushed through the door of my building and ascended the stairs quickly. Felicity met me in the upstairs hallway and gestured to my open office door. The sheriff was in there, sitting in one of my client seats, and so was his daughter Amy.
I didn't know what else to do, Felicity whispered, so I told them to wait in there.
Cantrell's awake, I said, surprised.
Yes, but there's something strange about him. He looks and sounds like the sheriff, but he seems different in some way.
She looked flustered.
Alec, I've got a bad feeling about this. When he looks at me, it's like there's someone else looking out through his eyes.
Okay, I'll find out why he's here.
I'll make coffee, Felicity said,
quickly disappearing into her office. I stepped through the office doorway and said, "Hey guys, what's up?" When Cantrell turned to face me,
"Sample complete. Ready to continue?"